Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Stories with Briscoe and Bradshaw. I would be Bradshaw. That would be the WWE Hall of Famer, the Oklahoma legend, the shooter, the tap like you mean it, Mr. Gerald Briscoe. And this, a member of the Samoan Dynasty, a WWE Hall of Famer, member of the BSK, and one of the best guys, Mr. Briscoe, and ever I've ever had the privilege of knowing. He's our good friend, Mr. Rikishi. Keesh. Thanks for
joining. Thank you, guys. I miss you guys. Thank you for having me on the show. It's been a minute, you know?
It has been. The last time I saw you was at the basically the BSK reunion at the Taker retirement.
Oh, Lord. Man, it was one of those nights. I haven't personally touched Jack in well over 20 years. And when I got the call from the office to be able to show up, you know, to celebrate Taker's 30th year, it was a no-brainer for me. First thing I asked was, who's going to be there? And they told me the whole crew of BSK was going to be there. And it was already like, okay, it's going to be all now, you know? And so to finally get there just to see my old friends back in the day, it was definitely a blessing.
Hey, Vince McMahon asked Tim White the next day, he goes, I heard you went timber. Better believe I did.
Well, you know, we all, you know, much love and respect to Tim White, though. OG, but, you know, the backstory, Tim never really hung with us back in the day, the BSK crew, but he was always in a lot of our matches as part of the referee. So we loved Tim, you know, but that night, you know, we were all at the bar. And of course, when BSK gets together, it's always a bottle of Jack Daniels. And so we got there early before anybody got there to the bar. And we end up, you know, all the BSK members just start trickling in from their flight. And finally, last Taker comes through. Now the party's on now. So we pretty much cleaned out the whole bar. They had no more bottles of Jack for BSK there. So here comes Tim White. We haven't seen Tim White in 20-something years. And so Tim White, BSK, we have a special way of drinking Jack. And Taker used to teach and Yoko, bless his heart. They used to grab that shot of Jack and they'd pour it in there. You don't just drink it. You had to drink it and you had to gargle that sucker and then swallow it. Now, Tim trying to hang with us, JBO, for a good, you know, 5-6 hours. The last bottle, we all about ready to go to our room. We did that gargle. Man, we all grabbed that shot. Boom. Here goes Tim White. Boom. Here goes the gargle. And all of a sudden, we're all just sitting there, and Tim White just tumbled all the way back, took a freaking bump by the bar. Of course, you know, back in the day, the boys never left the boys when we're all partying. That was a no-no. If you all party together, we make sure you get back to the room. So the TV hotel in Orlando, you know how big that damn thing is. We were all in separate different rooms on different floors. So you can imagine us taking each other, dropping Tim White to his room, come back, take Phineas to his room, come back, we were taking Godwin to shit. By the time everybody was down to the room, we were freaking blown up already.
It was time for the wake-up call. Then you had to go make sure everybody got up on time.
I saw the video from Phineas Godwin. He showed me when everybody was on the ground.
Lord.
Phineas takes a bump. Henry Godwin goes to pull him up. Phineas gets all lovey-dovey and wants to hug him. Now they're on the ground. then Savio's on the ground. It was awesome.
Dude, we woke up the next morning to come to TV. We had no idea what the hell we were doing. But coming through security, getting into the building, I'll tell you, Jerry, we were just, no matter how much cologne you got on your suit, we was just reaping Jack Daniels. It was horrible.
You guys had to get half the production crew drunk from just being around the aroma when you walked in. I know how that is, man. Sometimes you feel so bad, you hit one of those nights like that. And then you got to catch like an early airplane the next morning, and you shower, you put all that crap on, and you go there, and all of a sudden you're sitting in the seat, and you start smelling yourself. Mm-hmm. And then here comes the businessman, comes in with a coat, tie on, all proper, getting ready for a hard day's work. He sits down next to you, and first thing he does is kind of look over at you like, well, what the hell am I sitting next to? Hey, flight attendant, can I move seats? Right. We get more people drunk like that. But, man, Kesey, as we were saying earlier, we've been trying to get you on in your schedule that finally allowed you to come on to us. But, man, you got such a historic and such a lineage in this business there. You got to be so proud of the Samoan heritage that you have, just like I am the Native American heritage. You guys are some of the greatest athletes that ever stepped in the square circle and ever stepped on the gridiron. When you were a kid, I think you played a little football in high school, and of course, your both of your boys went on to play a little collegiate football too. There, so what era of family was in the ring when you were in high school sports, and what drove you to professional wrestling?
Thank you, Jerry. For that, our family goes back deep, 75 plus years in this industry. Started all the way from Uncle High Chief Peter Maivia back in the day, and then broke into Uncle Peter Maivia broke in Uncle Afonsica, and Uncle Afonsica turned around and they broke me, Yoko and Sammy, which was Head Shrinker,
right?
Back in the day, and it's. I don't know. I really, people ask all the time, why is it so many of you guys in the industry? When you have teachers like, Afonsica, they were very, very hard on us coming into the industry. They never wanted us to break into the business. They wanted us to go play football, go do something else. But when we decided to come to a professional wrestling, which most of us, we all like to throw hands back in the day. In high school, we always got in trouble. And because of the siblings connected to Afonsica, that would be the go-to place to straighten our lives out, which they send the Tonkin kid to Uncle Afonsica. They send Yoko to Uncle Afonsica. They send myself to Uncle Afonsica, Umanga. So basically, we were all good athletes in high school. A lot of us played football back in the day, but we never excelled to the next level of college because we were already training for the business at age 17. So by the time we turned 20, Jerry, we were already the mentality. We were already pros in the industry. We were young. We were we were young horses ready to run in this industry.
Wow.
And back in the day, the promoters, when they see that, we got young talent that are smart, that can work and they get it. Oh, that's a promoter's dream.
Yeah. Exactly.
And so we were always, we were molded in a different way with our uncles. They sometimes they would send us out, like we'd go out to Randy Hills in Memphis or Carlos Colon in Puerto Rico. Well, shit, we get out there, we're like making $30. And after a while it tested us like, shit, I can't live off of $30. But at the end of the day, it was them teaching us to respect the money, the business that you're in, because they wanted to make it as hard as possible for us to quit. So either we learn to respect it and survive and beat the game, or you're just going to quit because it's not for you.
Right.
Wow. And so it trickles all the way down now, with Roman and the Usos that are there today. So.
Yeah.
What a story. You know, you grew up out in San Francisco. Was you a part of getting to watch the Cal Palisades with Alf and Siki when they were hot out there? Pat Patterson used to tell me some of the funniest stories about the Samoan lineage out there when he would go to get heat. That you guys sat in a section up in the balcony of the Cal Palisades.
The cheap section. Yeah, the cheap section.
But when that heat started, that cheap section couldn't hold you out. You guys were jumping over the balcony, charging the ring. He said every night he had to fight a Samoan getting out of the damn ring.
Well, you know, back in the day, that was a Roy Shire promotion territory. And we were young kids. I mean, when I say young kids, you know, me, Tonga Kid, Yoko back in the day, I want to say we were maybe 6 years old. And it's in the nosebleed. So we used to go watch Uncle Fuji, Uncle Afonsika, you know, Pat Patterson, Ray Stevens back in the day, because my father was a security guard in the Cow Palace. And so we'd always, like, every time they come, we would be there. Of course, when our uncles are booked. But here's the thing, Jerry, because not only we seen them in the Cow Palace like that, but when they came to the Bay Area, we always had a Samoan barbecue. We opened up our home. So all the boys on the show, they would come eat at the house. You know, the boys, wherever they can get a free fucking meal, they're going to be there.
Hey, John, and we can't have
it. We on a free shirt. The boys will be there every time.
You know the deal, John. You know?
We come along at the wrong time, Don. They get that Samoan feast out there. Man, yeah. I'd die for one of those things.
And so when that happened, after we all got together, they got to meet the inside of our family. You know, my mother and my aunties, they all like, you know, they all loved the boys when they came over. They wanted our Samoan culture to make them feel comfortable, make sure they got stuff because they know that the boys been on the road and they're coming somewhat home here. So we would eat and then we'd go to the Cow Palace. Now, we used to get time to go in the back locker room. And when you're a little kid and you see all of a sudden this guy that was eating your food at your house, now he's talking shit to your uncle and all that. It's like kind of, you know, we wasn't smart. We was like, wait, what's going on here? And so to be able to see that when those, you know, when the heels came out, you know, versus, you know, Pat Patterson was one of the top heels out there. When he wrestled Uncle Peter Maivia in the Cow Palace, I want to tell you, gentlemen, soon as they see Uncle Peter Maivia hit, he was juiced and open, wide open, right? You can almost feel all the Polynesians wanting to hit that damn ring. You know, and that's how good, like, that's how good freaking Pat Patterson was back in the day, you know. And
he can break bread with you in the afternoon, then break your bone that evening. You'd want to fight him, want to hug him in the afternoon, sharing bread with him, but you'd want to fight him at night when he was fighting your uncles.
Yeah, they would always, smart booking, they would always bring Peter Maivia back to the Cow Palace, bring Uncle Alpha and Sika back. So they put Uncle Alpha and Sika, and of course, in a tag. Put Uncle Peter in a single, and they would, what, I think that place holds 15,000. So every month you got those guys going up against Pat Patterson or Ray Steven. You know, every now and then they'll bring in Andre the Giant. Right. So it was a perfect hub for the Polynesians. That's why when the head shrinkers went, remember back in the day, Jerry and John, when we went back to the Cow Palace, man, I used to freaking hate going back to the Cow Palace because the company would book us. They knew we would draw because Polynesian demographic, all up, you name it, Los Angeles, San Diego, you know, anything up in the West Coast, just Polynesian galore. But the thing is, by the time we get back from seeing our family, I get my freaking paycheck. I got like 1,500, 2,000, 3,000 off from the tickets that were given out. So I just told off. Please don't book me over there in the West Coast no more.
Cow Palace was such a great arena, but it was just a dump, you know, and you had to walk out underneath the people. So when you're a heel there, I'd always do the fake start because the shit would rain down from the roof.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as they'd see the heel come out, they would throw everything at you. So I'd always do the fake move, stuff would go down. As they go to reload, I'd take off to the ring.
And who knows what they're dumping on top of you.
Oh, my goodness. You know what I mean? Yeah. They're brutal.
They're brutal over there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I was telling John.
I've seen some interviews that the family's done about High Chief Peter Maivia. Did you have a lot of interaction with him, your uncle, when you were growing up?
You know, John, again, we were young when Uncle Peter Maivia and Uncle Alpha, you know, back in the day when they'd come to the house. Peter Maivia, he actually lived in not too far away from the Cow Palace. And there's this big park there, which, you know, every April, once a year, the Samoan community, Polynesian community, we all come together and they have, you know, they play cricket. They have all these booths together and they recognize, you know, certain Polynesians through that year. And so, you know, pretty much, you know, our relationship with Uncle was just that as a kid, seeing this, you know, this high chief being respected in, you know, in the community. But when he came to, you know, the Cow Palace, it was like that huge baby face, you know, wrestler. So, you know, that's as far as, you know, what I can remember is just being around as, you know, a 6-year-old kid, you know, around all the stuff that, you know, Uncle Alpha and Sika and Peter Maivia did in the community back in the day.
Yeah. You know, I got a great story I was telling John a little bit earlier before we got on with you, Kishi. The first time that I was, you know, I came along a little bit after the high chief, Peter Maivia. So I missed him. But Alf and Siki, you know, they were in their prime when Jack and I were working. My brother and I were working steady. First time I'd ever touched bases with them, we went down to Puerto Rico, down that Bayamon outside arena, you know, 15,000-20,000 people. The damn place, of course, is packed. Carlos did a great job promoting down there. We're booked against Alpha and Siki. We didn't have a clue who these guys were, what they looked like, or anything about them. So, you know, baby faces go to the ring first down there. So we're in the ring, you know. Man, the ring is just crowded. All Puerto Ricans coming up to ask for signals. All of a sudden, we hear this commotion. We look back. First base dugout is the baby face. Third base dugout is the hill. So here comes out of that third baseman. Man, it's like everybody left the ringside and just rushed the third baseline. By the time they got to that third baseline, Alf and Siki had stepped out of that dugout. They did an about face. They were trampling over each other, stampeding over, trying to get back to the baby face. Because Alvin Sika, Jack and I looked out there. At that time, they had those afro hairs, you know, about 3 foot wide on each side of them. Jack and I looked at each other. Here are two little skinny Oklahoma boys, you know, big old boys, Samoan boys come out there. Jack and I looked, what the hell are we going to do? I said, I guess we're going to listen a lot tonight. You know? We did everything they wanted us to do, plus, man. But what a great guy to work with, and what great athletes. I mean, you look at the size of those guys, and then you get in the ring with them, and, you know, you kind of adjust your speed and your motion, you know, to your opponent a lot of times. Man, we didn't need to make any adjustments at all except to pick up the tempo a little bit when we were working with those guys. They were some of the best athletes I ever crawled in the ring with. And we had that natural chemistry with each other. And you know, we become brothers just right off the bat, you know, an island boy and a native boy. It's we become friends right off the bat, man. What good people they were.
You know, one other thing is, you know, your brother, Umaga, what an athlete. You talk about athletes. He wrestled a match with John Cena one time. I think it was a Royal Rumble. And, you know, that's when we had different commentary teams for different tables. So I was not doing commentary. I remember taking off my headphones and just listening to the crowd because I was sitting ringside. And at one point, Umaga goes running across the tables and does a splash. Cena moves. He goes to the table. It was one of the best wrestling matches I've ever seen. And I've seen tens of thousands of matches. Yeah. He was such a good athlete. It was unbelievable to watch him in person work.
Yeah, well, you know, Eki Umaga, you know, he was supposed to go and play NFL football. You know, so my brother Eki here, you know, he wasn't raised here in the United States. He was back home, back in the islands. And, you know, he was a big star playing in high school. He was like, you know, back in the day, he was like 230. This is, you know, a sophomore, like 230, 245. And Eki was like 6'2", but he was playing running back, you know, and he used to just, oh, you know, and back home, you know, those days there, you know, for some reason, he couldn't run, John, in cleats. Like, Umaga couldn't run in cleats. So when it came time he played, he'd be the only one out there running barefooted. Like, no cleats, you know? And so, you know, he became a huge, huge star. And then, you know, in football back home. But my uncles, Alpha and Sika, back in the day, used to take, like, independent wrestling back home to the island. So he would bring guys like, you know, Kamala, Ken Patera, SD Jones. You know, probably some of the kids that are listening here probably don't even know a few of the names there. But Eki was like the kid to help all the boys get their stuff back in the islands. And so he would, you know, he was like a natural athlete. You know, we'd sit there and, you know, be in the locker room, help Uncle Alfonsica bring the boys, get their stuff. And it's that teaching there amongst different of the talent that he sees on TV. Now they're there in the island. He got time to spend one-on-one time with different of the guys that came to the island. And so finally, one day, he just, told my parents and, you know, said he wanted to try his hand into the industry. And of course, we were like, damn it, another one. You know, go. You're gifted at playing football. Go NFL. But he wanted to try it. And, you know, we put him through the same deal. You know, same thing what Alfonsica put us through. And, you know, he became one of the biggest stars in professional wrestling.
Gone
too soon.
He would have been a big star for years and years. Mm-hmm. He was so talented. Watching him was a pure pleasure.
Yeah, definitely miss him, yeah.
Being in the talent development department for so long, I used to tell everybody at WWE, man, you know, I don't need to travel around the United States to find talent. Just buy me a condo down in Samoa. Let me go down there and because I love the beach. I love the island. Let me go down there and spend about a year down there, and I'll have us more damn natural talent than I could find in, you know, searching every college in the United States. The athletes down there, I'm surprised that, you know, the NFL, they probably have a combine or something down there that tests these kids in Samoa.
Well, you know, they did I was very proud. They did a big, huge 60-minute program thing on the athletes, the football players that are coming out from that small island. Mm. And if you ever get a chance to go back and check that out, you know, it had Troy Polamalu on there. And they talked about, you know, these kids, you know, our culture, John and Jerry, you know, as young kids, the men do all the work as far as cooking and stuff like that. So, you know, our cardio and stuff like that would go up to the mountains back in the day. We would go get all the stuff, like hunt for hogs to be able to cook that, you know, cook the hogs on Sunday morning dinner. You got to get up at 4 a.m. to prep all this food. But you get everything on a Saturday. So every Saturday was the same routine as a young Samoan kid. You would have to go up to the plantation. You go get the bananas, the grapefruits, the taros. Everything that you're going to have cooked for dinner for Sunday morning after everybody comes from church. And so all these mountains, you know, that's a lot of cardio. That's a lot of workout. By the time they get these, you know, these weave these bags, they put all the taro, the coconuts. We all know how heavy those damn coconuts are. Mm. So they'll put them, and you've seen them before, they put them on bags, and that's like our weights. And these young kids at the age of 6, 8 years old, 10 years old on up, they're carrying this sucker all the way back down the mountain. So by the time they come down, and this is consistent, this is the way of life. By the time they get to playing any type of sports, be it football, be it basketball, be it cricket, they're already ready. They're like, as far as being, you know, being in shape, you know, they're ready. All they need to be done is to be able to teach them, you know, how to play the game, what the rules are of the game, because otherwise, it's just full-blown rugby. Soon as you get the ball, you're asked, my job is just... But, you know, nobody smartens them up. They got to be able to learn. And, you know, when 60 Minutes came down and did that, they did a lot of recruiting, a lot of Polynesians from Samoan Islands, the Tongan Islands, where, you know, Haku, Barbarian's from. Also out there in Fiji, where Jimmy Snuka's from. So there's, you know, very proud of a lot of Polynesians that come out from the islands.
And not only that, the respect they have. You know, I'm friends with Wasel Serebi, who's probably the greatest sevens rugby player of all time from Fiji. You know, Fiji has by far, the gold medalist last mm-hmm. year in the Olympics and sevens, best sevens team in the world. So I run a program, you know, using rugby to help at-risk kids. And in Bermuda, we brought over the team that was the Islanders from the United States to play Saracens, which is the best rugby club in the world. So you've got these great athletes. When the game is over, you know, everybody was out drinking beer, watching the guys play rugby. We look out there and the Islanders, as the team name was, is out there picking up the trash from the stands. Hmm. And I told my kids, I said, look at that. That's some of the best rugby players in the world. And we've got maintenance to pick all this up, but they wouldn't leave until the field was clean. It was one of the coolest things I've ever seen. Of course, we all went down there and helped them with it, but it's such a respectful, wonderful culture.
Well, you know, it's the culture of, you know, what we call kumama. Kumama means wherever you go and anywhere. They don't care what type of celebrity status, or even if you're not a celebrity. You know, when we come to different places, we learn to clean up the mess that we made, or maybe the mess that we didn't make. It's just in us all the time, because it's that work ethic that's instilled to us as young Polynesian kids. You know, the worst thing that they did back home now, guys, is they open up freaking fast food restaurants.
Uh-huh.
So when they open fast food restaurants, all of a sudden the Polynesians are like, oh, it's just easy to go through, drive a car through and just order your food now versus going to prep it up, you know, in the mountains and get all that, you know, done. So, you know, now, you know, the Polynesian kids here in the States, when they go to the Polynesian kids back home in the island, they're having like to be able to, you know, kind of find each other, because American Samoans, Polynesian kids, they're easy to the easy life, meaning I could just drive to the drive-thru, get me some food. Here, it's work. Like, you got to work to be able, you want to eat, yes, you want seafood, you go swimming, go fishing in the ocean. You want some good meat, you go up there, go hunting. But here in the United States, you know, when they come from the States, it's like that. They're so used to, you know, not understanding, knowing what their culture is. And that's why I always preach a lot to the kids here in the States. Learn to take time to go home to the islands of Samoa where you're from, and go learn to really understand, you know, what your culture is, how they live on a daily basis. Because you really can't learn here what your culture here is in the United States. It's just a whole new different vibe.
You mentioned a name when you're running down some of the name from the island there, Haku. We got Tonga down here in Florida. I mean, he was just a kid. Well, I didn't realize how young he was. So what Jack and I's routine was, we'd always get a rookie, you know, and let them drive a car. And we would sit there and drink our beer, you know, so we stay out of trouble most of the time. So when a Tonga kid at the time, come to Florida, all right, kid, here's the car, you know, here's the keys. Well, I really don't know. You just get behind the wheel and go. So we'd get down there and we'd notice the guy was so erratic in his drive. We found out the kid was only 16 years old and didn't even have a damn driver's license, never driven a car. Until we got him driving a damn car, we're two drunk idiots.
You know, this is a true story here, Jerry. You know, my brother, the Tonga kid, Sam Fatu, you know, he teamed up back in the day with Jimmy Snuka when they had the Piper versus Bob Orton. And so back in the day, Jimmy, you know, with Vince, whatever drama that they had amongst each other, they had to fill in that spot. So in the meantime, here's my uncle Alfonseca. They told Vince, hey, we got our nephew that can fill into that spot there. And so, you know, they throw a Tonga kid into the match. And next you know, they're going all around Philadelphia, Boston, you know, Boston Garden, came back to the Madison Square Garden. And, you know, he was the youngest one professional wrestler to ever sell out the Madison Square Garden. And so it was one of my proud stories that I tell about he's younger than me. You know, it's Rikishi, his Tonga kid, then his Umaga. Right. Wow. So there's the three brothers in from my uncle's Alpha and Sika's, you know, our mother is Uncle Nafasika's sister, older sister. And so the Tonga kid, now he broke in before me. So I come there, you know, your younger brother trying to show off to you. You know, he comes in, he goes back in the back and he gets a draw from Arnie Skolin. Arnie gives him $5,000. The young kid, 17 freaking, however, whatever, old, you know, he was like 17 years old. So I'm watching this. He's counting, Arnie's counting all this $100 bills. And I was like, shit, you made that for tonight? He said, that was just a little bit. And in my mind, I was like, okay, keep in mind, I was just training. I haven't broken the business yet with Uncle. And then I was like, okay. So we're getting ready to go to the next town, to Boston Garden that night. I'll tell you something, gentlemen, that probably you don't know, but my brother can't read or can't write, right? But he was so over with Jimmy Snuka back in the day, like his angle, he would have fans. He would tell fans, they'd give you some tickets. You want to, you know, go with me on the road. We're going to Boston, Massachusetts. We would follow all these fans, these different fans to the arena where he's got to work. His, they had those, you remember those big maps back in the day?
Yeah. Right.
Oh, we don't even see those damn Atlas maps anymore, yeah. Right?
I don't think anybody can read them today.
Yeah,
I don't need everybody had one in the back pocket there, your back seat there. You just reach back there. Where am I?
That was like the old school, you know, you had a cooler
GPS, yeah.
You had a cooler full of beer and you had those big Atlas maps.
Yeah, but, that's right.
So and OAG for us later, guys.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we had the OAG.
And so that was one of the stories that I like to tell about my brother back in the day, you know, being so young. But he was that exactly, Jerry, what you're saying. He would be the guy to jump in and he would drive us all over the place. Like, you're paying your dues, you know, go get the suitcase out the back of the trunk, back the trunk up, blah, blah, blah. But he became a good worker with him and Haku, as the Islanders with Bobby Heenan. You know, they were one of the best tag teams. I used to love watching them work against the Hart Foundation back in the day.
I know it's family, but you had to have favorites, you know, of your family growing up in the ring, who you enjoyed and who you kind of wanted to be like, and or did you just take a little bit from everybody, or how did you structure yours? Because you had so much diversity in your family to pick from.
Well, you know, body-wise, I always wanted to be like Jimmy Snuka. Of course, that never happened. Jimmy Snuka.
We all did, brother.
I did. For some reason, like, I tried as a young kid, and my genes just didn't agree with me, whatever the case. And so, you know, that with Jimmy Snuka. With Uncle Afonseca was, for me, was like the respect level towards people, towards them in the industry. It seemed like to me, Jerry and John, like every time somebody met Uncle Afonseca, it's like they feared them. They judged the book already by its cover before really getting to know them, like in the ring. Like they look like that, like they rip your
head off. They scared the hell out of me. I mean, the truth, I'm a young kid and I'm looking across that ring in Puerto Rico, man. I see these two monsters out there. They're like aliens, you know. Holy shit. I know what I can do, but I don't think I can do it against those guys. I started having self-doubt. You know?
And finally, when you do get in the ring with them, you know, they were my uncles. So I was like petrified, scared of them, you know, like, you know, my mom gave them the green light to fuck me up if I didn't listen. You know what I mean? And when we got into training, I made one false move. This is me being green. I made one false statement to my uncle, Sika, like, oh, this stuff is fake. And he goes, stop what he's doing. He said, what did you say? I said, oh, no, I didn't say that, uncle. I didn't say that. Just come here. Get in the ring. I go to get in the ring. Here it goes. Soon as we go to lock up, when we went to lock up, this right elbow slid right into my private, my whole my mouth right here. Busted my whole teeth out, busted my, I mean, I was just, you would think somebody took a blade and cut my jaw, just gushing out blood. Now, when that happened, you know, he looked at me and grabbed me, really grabbed me and had me open my eyes and look at him. And he told me, if you're going to come into this business, don't you ever, ever disrespect my bread and butter. And fucking threw me down like a freaking rag doll. From that day on, every time I stepped foot in that ring, it was utmost respect in my mind. Because I keep that keeps flashing back to my head when, you know, my uncle popped me like that because I said something stupid like that, you know. And now, you know, as you train, this shit hurts. It breaks your body. It hurts, you know, it mentally messes you up if you're not smart. And mentally, you know, physically, it can really damage your body if you're not learning your correct fundamentals. And to be able to perfect your craft in this squared circle, as they always told me, that no matter how good you are, that squared circle, the three-quarter plywood ring, wins every night. Our job is to survive it.
So, you know, one thing that was so disarming about, say, your uncles, when I met him, it was the same as, you know, I became pretty good friends with Haku when he was in WWE. And we talk about his kid was playing at UTEP at the time, playing linebacker down there. We go eat steak on TV days. And they're so respectful and almost quiet, you know, and humble when you meet them. And I remember sitting there with Haku so many times and I'm thinking, this guy's a killer. He's an absolute killer. But you never know it by talking to him. Maybe by looking at him and saying, you know, he's a really big guy. But, you know, you never – he was so humble and so respectful. The entire family was like that. I know he's not part of the family, but he's, you know, being an Islander. It's just that culture that breeds that. It's a remarkable thing. And it's very disarming when you meet for the first time about how humble and respectful Islanders are.
Well, you never want to judge these. You never want to piss these guys off. And I'm talking about Uncle Alfonseca or Haku, Barbarian, you know, Uncle Jimmy back in the day. You really never, for us being up underneath that umbrella, we've learned a lot just by watching all of us. Like what to do, what not to do, what to say, or when to get the hell out of the way. I mean, they're, you know, all the examples that we've seen as young rookies coming up in the industry. You know, I got to pay it all to them because they really paved the way for us younger Polynesians in the bloodline coming up, you know, to kind of smarten us up what the industry is about. And, you know, the domino effect as being a Polynesian kid from the islands, as just representing Polynesian all over the world. Like, you know, they teach us look beyond professional wrestling, you know, because professional wrestling is going to be your platform to be able to domino effect into personal lives of the kids that are coming up in Polynesian today. So, you know, it's been a blessing for us to still have our uncles around.
I saw a great story that I was watching some interviews, getting ready for this one with you to make sure I had your history right. Because, you know, even when you're friends for a long time, you don't know everybody's full history. So looking through some interviews today, and I saw a really cool story about you and Yoko. I loved Yoko. I went on the tour with Yoko a couple times in Japan when I first started. He was always so nice to me. But he helped you out in a big way when you needed it with heat in your house and didn't have any money. Tell a story. That's a really cool story.
Well, you know, back in the day, Yoko was, won the championship belt back in the day. So Yoko was the guy, you know, and me and Sammy, we were like, mid-carders back in the day. And of course we won the belts and I'm thinking, okay, we got the belts. We ought to make some real good money now. Right. And so what happened was I dipped most of my savings and I just signed a contract with WWE. So I dipped most of my savings. I said, damn it, I'm going to buy me a house for my kids. Make sure we're going to start off with that. So when I bought this freaking house here, a couple of weeks, we were on the road and I got a call from my family, like, you know, Sefa and my twins, we were young back in the day. And this house had no heat in there. And it was freaking freezing back in Pensacola, Florida. So me and Yoko was on the road and Yoko loved my kids. I mean, it was Uncle Rodney. When Uncle Rodney came home, like he'd shower these kids with $100 bills, go buy them this good. And I'd get hot at him because I'd tell, quit giving my kids $100 because I can't give them that. So every time you come home, it's like, you know, they're all happy to see you and stuff. But when I come home, it's like, their wedding. I'm not going to give them the $100. And so he would pull out, when he found that out, John, we were riding on the highway, and, you know, the following morning I was coming home, and, you know, he said, what's wrong? I said, man, my freaking heat went out in the house. It's freaking cold. I got to figure something. He could feel that I was stressing. You know, how can I, where can I make a loan, or how am I going to fix it? He popped open his checkbook, man. He signed it, didn't even put a number on there, and he just gave it to me. Wow. He says, go home and fix the heat for your family, and, you know, take care of my, you know, my sister and my nieces, my nephews and stuff. So, but that was just a little inside piece how Yoko was. That's just one person he was generous to. Like, he would even be like that to the boys. If we all go out to eat together, the bill would come sometimes $800. You know, maybe 400 was Yoko. Because Yoko, you know, he put it away back in the day. But we'd be 800. Before we get to grab our bill, it's already been taken care of. You know? And he'd done that numerous times for our family. You know, those that didn't have it so good in life. You know, he would just secretly in silence reach out and just would take care of that, what needs to be taken care of. So he was just a good-hearted person. You know, he just loved people, loved to help people. You know, and Rodney was that type of person, you know, in the locker room.
Oh yeah.
He's the giant.
Just a sweetheart. A sweetheart of a guy. Just a wonderful person.
And he loved you too, right here. He loved you, Jerry. Oh. He loved JBL. You know, I know that for a fact, you know.
Oh, I just love him. You know, he was just he was such a kind guy. I just loved being around him. He was funny. He was real funny. He loved to rap. It was such great.
The big free stuff. Before there was Snoop. Before there was Snoop Doggy Dogg, there was Yoko.
That's right.
And Yoko was such a leader in a dressing room too. I think a lot of that's missing in our history of our business, because he was a leader, and he was, of course, he was a huge guy. But not only was he a huge guy, but he was kind of the Undertaker before Undertaker became Undertaker. He was the guy that the guys would go to ask for advice and ask for, how do I do this? And Yoko was always there to help a brother out and to help a complete stranger out. And I just think that's just part of your heritage and part of your culture that you guys grew up in. Because, you know, as big and bad and as nasty and mean as you guys want to be, you guys are just a reverse to your friends and to people that really don't even know you. Some of the kindest folks out there. It runs through that blood, brother, that you got there. And that's the reason I think John and I both are so proud, you know, just to be associated with you guys and say, man, I knew him. I went up and down the road with him. I've had some fun with that guy. And they go, man, well, what are they like? I mean, I went to dinner with some friends last night. I told them we had you lined up. Oh, man, I love him. You know, and you still, I mean, after all these years, the family still brings a smile to everybody's face and that fear to everybody's face.
You know, Yoko was the Andre chair, you know, in the bus. You know, you had Andre and then you had Yoko was next, you know, and it wasn't just a matter of size. It was, you know, that was part of it. But he got that middle seat in the back, you know, that didn't have any seats in front of it. But it was respect. It was a respect that the boys had for Yoko, same as they had for Andre, then they had for Taker. You know, he always got that middle chair in the back because it was a matter of respect that you're showing respect to a guy. You know, he never had to ask for it, you know, because guys with real respect don't have to ask for stuff. They just get it because of who they are. And that's how Yoko was.
Well, you know, Yoko, you know, we all know sometimes when you have a guy that's in that top spot, you know, sometimes they can become assholes, you know, I mean, truth be told. But when Yoko was in that spot, when he was the one that was, you know, in front of the line back in the day, he never switched up. He never let that, you know, affect his relationship with the locker room. All of us is in there. You can never tell that he let that get to his head. He understood what his role was. And at the same time, he shared everything, meaning his knowledge, being, if you know, his wealth, if somebody needed help financial wise. But he was such a good, positive leader back in the days that you couldn't help but love this guy. Yeah. And if you didn't know Rodney, then you really didn't know who he was. You didn't take time to understand who this big giant with a humble heart. And then when you have guys like Taker, back in the day when Taker worked with Rodney, when they did that whole loop together,
yeah.
Now you got two guys at the top right there that was leading our whole crew back in the day. You couldn't help but learn. You couldn't help but, you know, it was a fun time for all of us to be on the road, to even be considered to be on that roster was a fun time for everybody, because not only you were making money, but at the same time, you were learning what was going on, how you're supposed to be. Because every day, we believe, every day that you're in this industry, it's always a learning process because of the time of the change, you know, how things, you know, move forward back in the day. So it's just, you know, I'm very blessed to be amongst you guys, you know, this crew here back in the day, because it really, really, for me and, you know, my family, helped us out a lot.
Yeah, you look back at Taker's ascension to that spot that he earned and deserved, you know, as the leader. You can see so much resemblance of things that he picked up from Yoko and during their course of just Taker getting his feet wet, so to say. And you could see that in Taker. And I think you can still see a lot of that leadership in there today, the kindness that this guy has, the respect. Yeah. It goes back to Yoko. And every locker room, you know, since the mid-60s, always had somebody like that. That you could look up to, that you could go and get advice from. But those two guys there, starting with Yoko and Andre, well, definitely throw Andre in there, because Andre earned all that respect too. But you know, in modern time, that we were constantly on the road with Yoko and Taker. Those guys, man, oh man, they were so similar in their leadership, and you too. I mean, you were a stand-up guy in the locker room too. The guys really respect, and that's what I always respect. I enjoyed working with you. I enjoyed, you know, helping you guys with your finishes and all that stuff. We had a great crew that really worked together. That there wasn't a lot of egos. I mean, we all had our egos, but we kept them in check in that locker room area and in that arena. And I think that's the reason we clicked and became so good.
You know, I want to say this to John. You know, when I found out I was coming onto this show here, you know, back in the day, I don't know if John remembers, this was way back when JBL was first coming in, came in with the Cowboy. I think you were with
Barry.
Dutch Mantel.
Yeah.
So this is where I first start learning that 360 bump. Remember, John?
Yeah.
So we go out now. This is John's first TV, I believe it was.
That's right. Yeah.
And then we'll say, we're going to put this guy over, blah, blah, blah. So I'm looking at John. Fucking John was jacked up, man. I was with the clothesline. I said, got you. So in the meantime, I just learned how to do this freaking 360. Right. I think the match was like 30 seconds. They wanted him 1 minute or 30 seconds. Man, when John came and we went in and had that match, Jerry, I already knew to my mind what I was going to do to him. I said, you're going to throw that clothesline, and I wanted to do that 360 for you. And in my mind, John, I was hoping that I landed right for you. And when I did, Jerry, I had no choice but to go over, right? When John threw that lariat and I hit that 360, for me, I was like, damn it. Hell yeah. Because to me, I wanted to deliver that move for you, especially when I was practicing, right? When that happened, I for some reason, that just came up to my mind when I was like, man, the first time I met John was that time when he first came in.
That's right.
And he was getting ready, you know, they were getting ready to put some steam out from under me.
I can tell you to this day, that was one of the coolest things ever done for me, was what you did. Because they told me you were in Fatu, and I saw it's awesome, man. Because, you know, I knew you from Texas. Not knew you, but knew, seen you in Texas. And I, you know, when I got there. And all of a sudden, you're going to put me over. And I thought, you got to be kidding me. And you were awesome with it. And then he took that massive bump for me. To this day, that was one of the coolest things anybody's ever done for me. It's, I had so much respect for that. It was so cool.
All love, my friend. All love. The domino effect of 20, 30 years forward, you know, it's things that we utilize our platform here for a lot of the kids in the future to understand that. You know, this thing here, know your role.
That's right.
It's time for other people to come through. I teach my kids in the academy, the wheel turns. So when it's time for us to put another person over, go do the best job you can, because that's what you're getting paid for. So, but anyway, I love you, my friend. That brought memories back when I found out I was coming on. I wanted to think, when did I first meet John? And that's what happened.
So much respect for you, because you could have said no. You know, you could have told them to do it. And you just, it's great. He's a new kid. Let's give him a chance. Put him over. We're going to put him over strong. And I did the same, you know, when I was, as I got, you know, in my career where I was doing the same spot, you know, I had a chance to put over, you know, CM Punk when he first came in, and Cena and those guys, you know, and that was my role. And I said, I'm going to put you over as strong as possible. I remember the first time we're in Madison Square Garden, me and CM Punk were in the last match. And I said, you got to make your name in the garden. I'm going to work my ass off tonight for you. And I'm going to put you over right in the middle, which is what was called, you know, it wasn't like I came up with that. But I remember, you know, that was just the respect that you get coming down the business from guys in my past, you to guys to me. Okay, here's what I'm going to do to pay it forward. And that's what you're supposed to do. Not everybody does it.
Right.
When it happens, you got much love for people who do something like that.
And sure. I think that's the reason the three of us are here together today, because we realized the business was just out of business. You know, when it comes your time to move on, it's your time, you know. And so we had such a great crew working at that time. And like I said, you know, the ego stayed in check. If they didn't, we had guys like you, Kishi, and Taker to bring those egos down to the Godfather. And Layfield with his lariats.
That's right. And we had so much fun. Keisha, I don't know if you remember, there was a time that me and Barry Windham were in Oklahoma. And it was we had a Polaroid camera. So we drove all over Oklahoma and it took a picture of me going to the bathroom on the state sign. And then we went to Jerry Briscoe's hometown. And I'm about to go to the bathroom with Barry taking a picture on his hometown. And you and the Sheik passed by.
Oh, Lord.
And the Sheik thought my name was Brad Shaw, two names.
Yeah.
So he sees me out there in the middle of this field by the city limit sign, and he rolls down the window and he goes, Mr. Shaw, is everything okay? And I looked around and it was you and Sheik, and I thought, what in the world are you guys doing here? I said, yes, Mr. Sheik, I was just going to the bathroom on Mr. Briscoe's hometown. He goes, excellent, Brad. You're such a fine young man. And you guys do it all.
Damn, Keisha, here you are, a brother with me, brother of the bloodline. Did you see this guy taking a whiz on my hometown, St. John? And you didn't give him a sink face. I'm disappointed.
I was staying in my lane, Jerry. I was staying in my lane. I knew my role.
Know your role, sucker.
You should put those pictures up in catering the next day. And I couldn't for Jerry to see him. And I'm sitting there waiting for him to walk in and see him, because I know he's going to stretch me. You know he's going to be mad. You know, like he always is.
I didn't need to. I got called in reinforcements.
I look in and freaking Jack Briscoe and Danny Hodge walk in. And I'm like, no. Of all people.
Jerry, only John does stuff like that.
I know.
You know, back in the day, John would go over and beyond to rip people back in it. So help me, if you got on JBL's bad side, forget it. You're in trouble, man.
So much fun.
Yeah, man. I definitely miss you guys, man. And so happy to see that you guys are doing well. And I'm happy for me now on a daily basis. I always tell my kids and my family, I says, if I wake up the next morning, we already winning.
Exactly.
That's right.
Amen.
What a wild ride you had, though. I mean, you started down there in a crazy place with the Von Erich boys. I mean, those boys.
Oh, Lord.
It was like a street fight. I wrestled Kerry and Kevin a bunch. I mean, I knew I liked both of them very much. But
you know, and that was some stiff some stiff competition. Like
and the original Michael Hayes, right?
Yeah. you had Eric Emery out there back in the day, Eric Emery.
Yeah, Eric.
Skandar Akbar. You know, we were young kids and we were thrown in there. Michael Hayes actually booked us over there and he stuck us with freaking Buddy Roberts. Me and Sally.
Oh wow. I had Sally.
So how that came about, you know, Uncle Alvo is the one that broke in Michael Hayes, right? From Pensacola.
Yeah, all Pecola guys. Yeah,
so they're all Pensacola. So that's how that happened, where Uncle Alvo sent us to Texas when Michael Hayes was in charge back in the day. So he said, I want to send my nephew and my son, and I want you to keep an eye on these boys here. We were like 18, 19.
Telling Michael Hayes to keep his eyes on teenagers is not a good advice. That's like Black Jack Mulligan when he sent Barry Windham down here to Florida. He come to Jack and I. He said, I want you to take care of my son. He's 18 years old and he's just starting in the business. We look, man, we'll take care of him.
Yeah, we was already corrupted. That started in Dallas, Texas, John. Once we were hooked up and Michael stuck Buddy Roberts with us, then you had Gordy out there with PSAs. Man, so you have these two young kids and we're traveling with the Freebirds. The rest is history.
Yeah.
And so they would always tell us.
What you can remember.
Yeah, they would always tell us that, you know, they would book us against the Von Erichs. You got Kerry and then you got Kevin, right? It's one of the, you know, Kevin just, man, if he throws something at you, you know it's coming.
It landed.
No, yeah. And then you're working with these guys here and you see them most of the time, they're in la-la land, you know, back in the day. So we're like, okay, you know, we're young. So you hit me, I'm going to fuck you up too. That was our mentality for us to survive, because we would call our uncles and say, damn, these guys are not wrestling us. We feel like we're getting beat up. So my uncle says, well, you know what a receipt is? I says, yeah. Then to give him a receipt. So we would go every time Michael was like ribbing us, would always book us with these guys. And when we book, it's like every night we're just fighting. Boom, boom. We would come back. We got a big knot on our forehead, potato in the back here. You know, after a while, I said, okay, this thing here is starting not to be fun anymore, you know? And so it just ended up that, you know, after a while, we kind of just got used to working with these cats. That was their way, and we just adjusted, man. But it was the rib from Michael Hayes to put Buddy Roberts with us and then have us booked against those guys there. So,
because they loved it. If you give them a receipt back, they loved it. It was fun to them.
Hey, I mean, when they swing that chair, John, you know, there's a way of swinging a metal chair. they swing that damn metal chair, you know? And we was like, well, screw you. We're going to swing it right back. And so it was that constantly. And, you know, finally when we got away from them, we were kind of relieved after that.
You know, the guys you had to watch, you know, Buddy Roberts was one, but, you know, Owen was bad. And Kurt Hennig was bad. How about when Kurt Hennig got you with the towel on the stink face? I mean,
Oh my goodness!
Only Kurt would do that.
Yeah. You don't even see that coming. Kurt is that smooth, and it couldn't have been a better place for him to do it in front of 70,000 people. I believe we were in Australia, John. We were in Brisbane or so, Sydney, and it was a big, huge Coliseum we were at. I worked against Kurt, and Kurt comes with his towel. I'm thinking that he threw his freaking towel. You know, out the ring. But by the time I come to give the stink face, he turns around, stick that damn towel right up the crack of my ass there. and he would just sit there and laugh and just laugh about it and have a good time. But, you know, that's how the old school cats were back in the day. Normally somebody would get hot, like, hey, you fuck my shit up, you know, in front of people. This shit ain't funny. For us, it was like, all right, you're one up.
Yeah, that's right.
You want up, I'll catch you the next time.
Yeah,
you
know? Payback's a bitch. Yeah.
That's right.
And that was the one thing back in the day. You didn't mind getting ripped, you know, because it was just,
no.
You just wanted to, you, all right, you got me. You got me really good. I'm going to get you back, but you got me really good.
You know what they say, you give a rip, you better learn how to take a rip. because you don't know what type of rib you're going to get, you know? I remember when Smoking Guns, you remember Bart and Billy, when they first came in with the cowboy gimmick. So we had an old Texas run. Of course, you know, they're great. And you know, we're cowboys. We're, you know, we're this superstar. So they tried to rib, Uncle Fuji.
Oh, which, Lord.
Okay.
Wrong guy. You,
absolutely.
Fuji. I loved it, but I was scared of it.
So they go in and we checked into the hotel. And then we told them, listen, we're following, you guys are going to follow us to the arena. Make sure you guys are not late. So these cats go up, and they must have done something to Uncle Fuji a week ago. Uncle Fuji didn't forget. So these guys here come, park. Remember, they used to rent those Cadillac DeVilles back in the day. It was a lot more roomy for the guys. So these guys just starting, but they rented that Cadillac DeVille. So I was like, this guy's already getting big-headed. We know they should be in a Ford Taurus, but they're in a Cadillac, right? So Uncle Fuji, as soon as they go upstairs, they park their car in the lobby, John. When these guys came back down, all the tires were off of the damn Cadillac. It was just sitting in the lobby. Guess who hit them? Uncle Fuji. They were late. They were late to the show and almost got fired. That's a hell of a rip, you know?
I told the God ones one night, I said they were messing with Hot Rod Roddy Piper on the road.
Oh, Lord.
I said, guys, don't mess with Hot Rod. He's crazy. No. He's crazy.
Oh, yeah.
So we're going from Austin to San Antonio, and one of them came up to me and goes, you got to come see our car. They pull up next to Hot Rod, and Hot Rod doesn't even look at him, just goes, bam, and hits him and keeps going. I told you, he's not going to mess with.
You know who's probably one, I don't know, probably the most gross rib that I've ever heard in my life was Uncle Fuji. So the wrestlers came to Uncle Fuji's house, and Uncle Fuji he'd barbecue. So what happened was one of his German shepherds passed away either a week before the boys were coming through. They turned around, and when the boys came through, he was marinating all this meat. He barbecued the meat, and all the boys are like, oh, my God, this is good. This is good meat, you know, blah, blah, blah. What is it? Uncle pulled out the head of the animal that passed away and put it up in front of it. Every single person that was there threw up. Like, that day, till this day, or, you know, when Uncle was alive, Uncle Fuji, I have never, ever even thought about ribbing that man.
No.
Even when we're on the road, never. I would never even cross my mind to rib Fuji.
No. He was the one guy that I remember. I was scared of him. And he was such a wonderful guy. He was pleasant as he could be, but I was scared to be around him because you never knew. That man was evil.
Evil.
He's sneaky. He's very sneaky. Yeah. You know, he was really like, he smiled in front of you, but he'll get you. If he doesn't like you or something happened that you did to him, he might not get you today. He might not get you next month. He'll probably get you the following year.
You knew it was coming with Fuji, though. You always knew it was coming with Fuji. King Curtis and Mark Lewin and Fuji, they were all in Australia. My first year in the business, I got a trip to Australia. And so we went over to Singapore back in those days. And I can say this now because we're more open and everything. And I was a part of it. But you could buy Hershey bar sizes of hash, the hard hash. And we'd smuggle them back to Australia. I know the statute of limitations problem smuggling hash. I hope it's over with, but there's no evidence, believe me. So Lewin and Curtis didn't trust each other with the cookies. So they had Uncle Harry hold a cookie for them. Well, every week, you know, after we'd finished with TV, we always had like a Perth with like a, you know, from Sydney, like a 7-hour flight to so they'd break off a little piece of that cookie and eat the cookie. So each week they noticed that cookie getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And Fuji was supposed to be off the stuff at the time, per Barnett. So one night they were there. So they called me to the room. We can't trust Fuji anymore. You know, we're going to give it to you, Briscoe. So I said, what? I didn't even know what a cookie was, or, you know, what it was made of. That's how naive I was at the time. And so
I was dating this little Australian girl, and I told her about this magic that I had. Of course, she wanted to try it. So, of course, I wanted to stay with her. It warned me, man, that stuff was the best I ever had. I didn't know it was that damn masculine stuff, you know, that, like peyote, you know, that trip your mind out. But then Lewin and Curtis come to me, and I had like a little square left of that damn. Go damn, Briscoe, what happened to it? We are better off with Fuji having a damn thing. and the next week, Fuji come up to me, and he gave me a Hershey bar. And I noticed something funny about it, but it was real funny. So I said, thank you, Fuji. And so Lewin pulls me over. He said, kid, don't take that. He said, you're cooking. He said, it's excellent. Fuji spent all week making that thing because you ate all the damn cooking. So I pretended in front of Fuji that I was eating it, you know, and then I'd have to go, of course, with a big laugh and everything. For years and years, he ribbed me about eating his cooking that I never ate.
You know, guys that don't know back in the day, you know, when you have a rib, you'd always say, you know, we need to call Fuji Investigations.
Yeah.
And that meant that meant no one's going to look into it.
All right. Yeah, exactly.
That was the best. He was so much fun to be around, but I'm telling you, I was scared of him. I just thought, you know what? I'm scared to leave my bag here. I'm scared to leave my boots here. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm a young guy, and I'm around Mr. Fuji.
And he could strike you in any type of rib. He could strike you.
That was the OG and Uncle Fuji, man. He'd smile in your face, but he's already plotting. He's already plotting. He's like, I'm going to get you sooner or later before you even know it, you know?
So tell us a little bit about your school, your academy that you have going, and how's it going?
Oh, well, we're doing good. It's here in Los Angeles. We've been open now for well over 12 years, Jerry. Wow. In Los Angeles, the Knox Pro Academy. It's KNOKXPRO.com. So, you know, we've been doing good. You know, for most of my time, you know, for some reason, like I just, you know, I couldn't, you know, get away from the industry, meaning that, you know, my uncles opened up a school back in Florida. Sammy opened up a school up in Allentown, Pennsylvania. And we needed a Samoan Dynasty school out towards this way in the West Coast. So I guess, you know, the teachings of what's passed down to us is like, it's important for us to have these kids, you know, be able to understand the ins and outs of the squared circle. You know, a lot of kids, when they come to us, I like to call them PlayStation wrestlers. That's because they all come through, Jerry, John. They have no idea. Like, you know, they're already talking about spots. You know, I can do this spot here. I think blah, blah, blah. Or talking about their gimmick. It's like, how about you learn how to work first? How about you learn fundamentals of what it is to be a pro wrestler? What comes with it. So, you know, majority of my time, you know, we have classes on Wednesdays and Thursdays from 6 to 9 p.m. It's like 3 hours a night. And then on Sundays, we do an open ring on 10 a.m. to 1. So, you know, I have them repeat what they've learned on the Wednesday and Thursday. And when they come into the open ring, I look forward for them to incorporate that, what they've learned, trained on those days, to be able to, you know, to perfect their craft. So, you know, we do everything from, you know, everything that has to do with the industry, from learning how to talk, you know, cutting promos, you know, your ring awareness, you're learning how to feel a person. Like, how do you work with a person when they don't speak English? It's very, very difficult. For us, what worked for us back in the day, what we were taught, is we feel a person now. Soon as I lock up with a person, if I feel them that they're snug, okay, I kind of got that. If I go to lock up with him and tell him, throw me in a headlock, we send him off and he comes back, give me a tackle. If he runs through my shoulder, now I know what type of worker he is, meaning he doesn't have controlled movement. So this type of guy. So everything
when we're working with these type of people, with students, you know, we give them the certain techniques, what was taught to us. Like we were learned, you know, we were taught to look at your stepping, your footing. You know, I don't know you, but I'm trying to find you as soon as we get in the ring. Like how you said, when you got it with Alfonseca, you never even, you know, work with them. But those little techniques, we take what you guys have used back in the day and we incorporate it with the kids today because we feel right. It's important for them to know.
You know, that's a great point because I worked in Japan a lot like you guys did too. And you're working with guys who don't speak any English. And you go over the finish, but you still have to go sometimes 20, 30 minutes with these guys. You know, it's hard to explain to people how do you work with a guy who you can't really communicate with, but you do. You know, and it's feel. It's just all feel. You know, it's crazy to try to explain it to a layperson. How are you working with this person? Because it's so hard to explain without having been in the ring with somebody like that and understand what that feel means. But it really is a feel thing when you have somebody that doesn't speak the same language. Mm-hmm. It's tough. You know,
and your style is completely different too. I mean, from an Asian style to a United States style, and you go over there and then you got that language barrier. You just got to feel it. Like, you know, I used to talk to my brother and Dory Funk Jr. all the time that when they were world champion, they would travel night to night. You know, and they one night they'd be in Tampa, Florida, taking on the best. Next night, they'd be in San Francisco taking on a Pat Patterson or a Ray Steven. They'd never seen these guys before, but they had to go out and they would adjust to them. At least they could speak the same language, but Dory and Jack always told me, I could lock up with a guy and knew how far I could go with a guy, you know, just by the lockup. And it's that old school feel that all three of us come up with that's so important in today's business, you know, is it feeling a guy and checking the ego, you know. Yeah. And I'm sure you go over that a lot.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, for us when we're doing the feel thing with them, we're trying to find them, and it's also like you got to be well aware to be able to protect yourself because you don't know what this guy, can he throw a punch? Is he able to pull that punch or does his punch go all the way through? So, you know, it only takes 30 seconds for you to end your career. Yeah. Meaning if this guy come from behind and punch you from behind, hits you in the wrong spot in your vertebrae, you're done, right? So why would I let him hit me first? I would probably do a spot just so I can see his punch, see if he's able to pull it. Or, you know, how does he throw his punch? And then I'll be able to call another spot, which I feel is safe, you know, because, you know, we know that accidents happen in our industry. No matter how good of a pro you are, you can get in there and you can have an off night and something happens. And God forbid that off night help puts you on the shelf, meaning your career is done. You're unable to walk, your vertebrae is gone, whatever the case it may be. But so we highly teach, you know, safety, highly teach perfecting your craft. Don't do the things that you don't know how to do. You need to practice first to perfect that before you're able to do that to somebody else's body. Because if I'm giving you my body, your ass go to pick me up and slam me. You better know how to pick me up upside down. Because if you don't know how to pick me upside down and I fall on my dome, now the domino effect, you hurt me. You hurt my family. You hurt my kids. You hurt my food on the table. I mean, the domino effect of that, of the decision that you make. So you better make sure you have it right.
And you're hurting the business on top of it. So,
yeah.
Look, Keith, one of the old school guys when I saw come in was your two boys, the Usos.
Yeah.
I called most of their first matches on the pre-show. And you know, a lot of times they booked those pre-shows. There wasn't a storyline. There wasn't an angle. They said, what are we going to do with the pre-show? They need like 20, 25 minutes. To, okay, let's get so-and-so out there and put so-and-so with them. And there was no, you know, just people were filing in. I'd watch those two kids go out there with no angle, no storyline, and really nobody knew them that well. They knew they were your sons, but they didn't really know the Usos. They, every single time, tore the house down. And I'd come back from the pay-per-view, and I would always ask, because a lot of guys didn't watch the pre-show. I said, do you guys see the pre-show? You have any idea how good these two kids are? they stole the show every – I've never been so proud to see two guys who were so respectful and such good workers. I knew there once I got with Roman, this is going to be huge. That's one of the best tag teams I've ever seen. And I seriously mean that, ever. They were so good to go out there and perform. You know, so many guys would go out there for that pre-show and they just kind of put a match together. They'd go out there and feel the crowd. And I'm sitting there calling the match, and I know nobody hardly in the back's watching it because they're getting ready for the pay-per-view. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. These guys are awesome. It's got to make you so proud to see those guys go out there. Even, you know, now they're obviously they're huge stars, but even at the very beginning, just to go out there and turn something that was not that great, like a pre-show, into something magical. Because I know you could see it as well.
Well, you know, John, first of all, I'm very, very proud as a father, to be able to see my boys out there, you know, doing the thing that they planned out to do. Thankful for the opportunity, you know, that's given for them to get out there to do what they do. You know, the kids, they, you know, they've been around the business, you know, all their lives. You know, for some reason, when you have these generations, you know, these second generations that's around the locker room, around the boys when we're traveling, and just around the industry, you know, it's a different type of vibe. Like, you know, they love it. They respect the business because that's what they're taught. Otherwise, you would have never been in there, you know. And to be able to, you know, a lot of times they, you know, they get frustrated. You know, we're always the pre-show, Dad. We're always the pre-show. We're always this. I say, hey, that check coming in every week. See, I kind of make them come back to where realize what it is. Is that check coming in every week? Yeah, the check's coming. Okay, just get out there. Be happy that you're given an opportunity to get out there on the card, be it a pre-show, be it a house show, be it a pay-per-view, and get out there, do the best you can. That's all you can do. The rest about you trying to fight everything else where you're at in the card, blah, that does not matter. What matter is, and this is us smarting you up on what it is, what matter is you're getting that paycheck, because that's what mattered to me. You ask about why did I have five freaking different character? The bottom line for your dad, I didn't give a damn. WWE could have threw a bunny on top of me. The bottom line is I wanted that paycheck every week to put food on the table for my family. So recognize what this is while you're in it. Recognizing you understand, then the rest of your passion, your talent is going to come out just organically. They cannot stop talent. Remember that. So just go out there, do the best you can and steal the show. And they've been doing wonderful.
Oh, they're incredible. And one of the problems they had with the pre-show was they were so good at going out there with a cold crowd and making them hot that they all ended up on a lot of pre-shows because of that.
But that's good for them. That's so good for them because you know you're not figured in. You know, this is you perfecting your craft now. You're being thrown into something where there's no angle. Nobody really knows who you are. That's what you get in there. You make people remember who you are. You get in there.
Exactly.
You steal a show because soon as the office back there notice notice that match on a constant basis, you guys are just killing it. Sooner or later, somebody going to be smart enough. We need to write these kids in. We need to put these kids in. And that's how you get there is through hard work.
Yeah, because the talent, you know, is there. You know, and on that pre-show, they would get 20, 25 minutes, which you wouldn't get on a pay-per-view. Yeah, you know, a tag team on a pay-per-view without a hot angle wouldn't have got 20, 25 minutes. So you wouldn't have got that opportunity to tell that great story like those guys got on the pre-show. And they were taking advantage of it. I'm sitting there watching it with Michael Cole every day going, these guys are incredible.
Yeah.
They're so freaking good.
You know, they kind of remind me, like we talked about the bloodline today with Roman and the twins that on the top of their game now, you know, everywhere you turn on TV, that it's always the bloodline, the bloodline, the blood. You know, I'm proud to see that, you know, kind of reminds me when Yoko was that back in the day, like versus Roman, but in a different era. Then you had the head shrinkers up underneath. But the difference is we wasn't making the same type of money that Roman and Usos making today.
No kidding.
So there, damn, you guys enjoy the ride because it's not going to last forever.
Enjoy.
Right, Jerry? It doesn't last forever. So.
Great advice, man. Enjoy that ride, man. It don't come around a second time. Yeah.
You ride that sucker till the wheels fall off, right, John? Yeah. We already Absolutely. Know that.
People ask me, what you do over again? Every bit of it?
Yeah.
Every freaking bit of it. I had the best damn time. And it's why Jerry and I love this show is we get to talk to you and have fun and just catch up and just bullshit, BS, and, you know, just have a good time. You know, there's nothing like it. We were part of one of the greatest business in the world.
Yeah,
and we got to entertain fans. I mean, you talk about going to Australia. We're out there in front of 70,000 people, man.
Yeah, and get a towel stuck in between your butt cheeks. And I got paid for it.
And plus get a 10K check on your return or more.
Isn't that right?
That's right.
So we have the best job in the world. No complaints.
Yeah, not even close. And we made it through.
We're here.
That's the important thing. We made it through. John and I just, you know, during the pandemic, you know, we were both bored and we're both kind of doing these goofy things on our own, just telling road stories and laughing at each other. And, you know, after a while, you run out of individual stuff. So John called me and he said, hey, man, let's do something together. You know, we both have a lot of road story, a lot of friends we can get a hold of. And sounds like fun. So we just, you know, we started this thing just to have a good time, just so we could talk to guys like Rikishi. And we had Eric Bischoff on last night or that last week. We've had Michael Hayes. We had Devon Eric on. We've had.
Oh, great.
We've had so many guys on, and we just sit here and laugh and tell good stories. And I think, you know, people enjoy hearing the fun side of our business, too, because there's so much negative bullshit out there nowadays. And it's good to come in and hear Rikishi laugh and see the pride that you have. But most of all, the respect for the business that every one of our guests has had on. Our business is a wonderful thing, and it can be a miserable life too if you let it be. But you know, we all were smart. We made the right friends and went down the road, and we laughed a lot. We had a good time, and we didn't go. We called minimal harm. I won't say we called any harm, but we called minimal harm. But Kishi, I mean, it's such a pleasure when we start talking about you coming on. Wow, this will be a fun one. Yeah, so thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Kishi, thank you. You know, when I came in, I think I'm only about a year or two, maybe a year at the most, younger than you, but I'm younger in the business. And you were always so cool to me. We became good friends, and I just so much love and respect to you, my brother. And I've always, whenever I see you, I just smile. And when your kids came in, I mean, I love those two kids. I'm so happy for their success. I'm so happy for everything that the family's done. It's just, it's so cool. And it's so great to see you. And when we first, you know, we made it through. We made it through.
And now
we're the old guys who can sit around and talk about it, not being bitter. Just say, you know what? We had our run. We had a run in the sun. It was awesome. And I still get to talk to great friends. And that's what life is all about. So thank you very much for coming.
You said something there, John, that just made so much sense for you anyway. You know, when you see a
see a green guy wouldn't have caught that. You see,
but when you see a friend and all you got, all you could do is smile. You know, that's a hell of a friend. You know? Yeah. And the same thing I think happens, you know, when I see you, Kishi, and when I see John. I just smile because I just think of all the damn good times that we've had and all the good times to come. So, man, it's been a pleasure, man. A time has flown by. And we appreciate you coming on. And one of these days, we're going to call you. We're going to have a big reunion of this show and have a bunch of guys on it and see how far we can get with that.
Absolutely. I'm down with it. Listen, Jerry, you know, I think I can say this. Behalf of me and John, you know, you, my friend, the domino effect that you have laid on our lives, you know, being in the business, you know, we've become close friends for a reason. Like, don't think for 1 minute back in the day that your generosity, your teaching has gone unnoticed for both of us. You know, so happy to see that years later, you know, you guys have, you know, linked up together to be able to do shows like this. You know, and it's important that, you know, at the end of the day, is like, you know, our platform here, letting the curtains down for fans to come through, just to understand that there is good people in this industry. There is people that really care about each other. It's not what you just see on TV, us working against each other, blah, blah, blah. But behind the scenes like this, you know, it's good to be able to, you know, fellowship together. It's good to be able to go down memory lane and, you know, and talk about the things that really help each other's career. And for you, my friend, Jerry Briscoe, you and your brother, you know, back in the day, thank you for being such a mentor to, you know, us and our family. You know, thank you for, you know, doing the dance with Uncle Alfonsica and Uncle Peter Maivia back in the day. So everything that you guys have done has helped us in our career and our choices to be able to be better people in this business. So thank you.
You're quite welcome. And it's passed on by your son there. And I appreciate that so much. It means so much to an old timer. But thank you, man. Yeah, our business is great, man. So let's all enjoy it. And let's watch the future, you know, and there's so much out there for these kids. And let's hope they all can take advantage of it like we did and go down the road. And then 20 or 30 years from now, they can sit in a group like us. No, they'll be proud. Probably be sitting with holograms sitting next to each other, you know. But, you know, this is what it's like when you forge those relationships when you're on the road and everything. We're all three here smiling and laughing because we're enjoying each other's company. And I hope that's one thing that we can all pass on, you know. Life is tough enough out there, so why make it tougher by holding a grudge or something that's like right. that, you know. So let's all get out there and kick ass, man.
All right. Love you guys, John, and love you guys. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you.